The following presentation was recorded at the 2001 Teachers Workshop at Faith Builders. More information on Faith Builders events at fbep.org.
Good morning. It's a privilege to be here. I just spoke with someone here in my 2 minutes to learn to know someone, and that, I forget his name, but I remember where he's going. What's your name? You're going to Paraguay? Derlin Beachy. And he's headed off to Paraguay for the first time in the country, first time in the continent probably, teaching 15 students in a foreign setting. And every one of you has a story like that. Every one of you has an assignment. How many of you will be teaching in a new setting this year for the first time, either a new school or a new student body? Or good. And that excites me, those challenges that we face. My bias, my perspective, I'm inclined to think of teacher. I'm interested in knowing who are the teachers. Somewhere down the line, we do have some things that we teach, and we have some content, and we have some things called curriculum and books. But it's the teacher, as we think of the various metaphors we could use for a school or for schooling, they really drive how we function. And one of those, as a teacher, if we think of the meaning of a teacher as a catalyst, that's helpful in some ways. That is, the teacher, the catalyst is something that really does not become part of the process, but without it, the process would not happen. Catalysts can both speed up and can slow down chemical reactions, and sometimes the teacher needs to do both of those. And there are ways that metaphor does not hold. The teacher actually does become a part in some ways. But I'd like to remember that the teacher, it does make a difference. It does make a difference, a big difference, whether or not the teacher is present and who the teacher is and how the teacher functions. I'd like to, before I launch into our topic here, I'd like to just remind you, in coming to a workshop like this, a series of talks, you'll hear from several different people. I'm reminded of the story of David and Saul's armor, when David said, "I'll go out there and I will tackle Goliath." And Saul said, "Well, here, you can take my armor." And he tried it on and he said, no, he said, I really don't think I can use that. I'm going to use my own sling stone. Now, as you come here, how do you handle this material? Do you sit there and very assiduously copy down and fill in all the outlines? And if you had only one speaker to listen to, then you could go back home and you could try to do as that person said you should do. The problem is you're going to have several speakers, and we're going to come at this from different angles. And so if you try to use that approach, you're going to wonder, well, do I do it the way this person said or the way that person said? Or do I just go back home and forget about those things and pick up my sling and just go at it, however? Well, the latter is the most likely description of what you'll do. You're most likely to go back home and do things the way you would do. You're mostly influenced by the way you were taught. That's probably the way you will teach. So, in conclusion, what I'm trying to say is, as you sit through these days, don't try to pick up a system, a complete approach, and go back home and be who you are not. You're going to have to be who you are when you go back home. But do pick up some ideas to wrestle with, and don't wait till you get back home to wrestle with them. You probably won't do it if you wait till you get back home. Do it while you're here. Saturday morning, we'll be asking you to share some ideas of things that you plan to do in your classroom. And so pick up something. If it's only one idea, that's more than nothing. Pick up something, some approach, some technique, some idea, some inspiration that you can take and use and actually make it part of you, so that perhaps you'll go back home with a newly designed stone for your sling, but continue to use the sling, or perhaps you'll modify your sling in some way. be equipped. Our topic is reading, writing, and speaking across the curriculum. There's a story told of a great teacher's method. A person came to a school of higher learning, and the teacher introduced him to it, to his studies, by giving him a fish and telling him to study the fish. And the teacher left the room and left the student there with the fish. Well, this fish was a preserved fish probably formaldehyde in those days. He studied the fish, and in about 5 minutes he was finished. And the teacher came back in about half hour and found to find out how it was going. And while he really didn't know what else there was to look at, he had finished looking at the fish. And the teacher informed him that he hadn't started yet. And so he said, I'll be back later. So he left for the rest of the morning and left this man with his fish for the rest of the morning to look at. And, well, he wanted to get into the school. He wanted to study under this teacher, so he had to face this lesson. So he looked at the fish some more and got sick and tired of looking at the fish. But finally he noticed something. This fish had symmetry. And then he got to thinking that, oh, there's something to see about this fish. And he took a pencil and paper and he started to sketch the fish. At some point, the teacher came back and saw him with a sketch pad, and he said, ah, you're starting. And he left the room again. And I forget how long it went, but I think it went a day. And by the time the day or more was over, why, this student and his fish and a pencil and pad, he had noticed wonderful things about fish. He had sketched the fish. He had pondered the scales of the fish and how they overlap, the shape of the scales. He had considered how fish move through water and what mucus they must have on their bodies. He had looked at the kinds of symmetry. He looked at it from all angles and all sides. He considered the eyes, the gills. He had sketched, he had drawn, he had written, and he was ready to start learning. Now, that is a bit of an introduction to how we can use reading, writing, and speaking across the curriculum. This relates somewhat to what Steve was talking about, but overlaps quite a bit, but there are some different distinctives here. I do want to point out that I'm aware that we teach in all different kinds of settings. Some of us have our students working through individualized paces or light units. Some of us are teaching in multi-grade classrooms. Some of us are teaching high school, grade school, specific subjects. And regardless of what we are teaching, it is important for students to learn to write. And most schools do some effort to have students learn to write, even if they are pretty much working through what you would call a packaged curriculum. So as you're working, if you work in that kind of a setting, I want you to listen with the ears of who you are. Think of how you're going to be teaching this year, what assignments you will have. And as we talk about these ideas, I'd like you to think of how you can use some of these in your setting. I'd like to, first of all, I'll be talking more about reading and speaking on other days, and today get launched in writing and talk about the social studies history area. In order to do that, though, I do need to talk slightly about reading, and so I'd like to look at some quotes here with you. One writer said, it is well to read everything of something and something of everything. Now, I want to point out that you as a teacher, you cannot teach that which you are not or that which you do not do. Now, your student may do far more than you do, but you must know something about it. And so I'm suggesting here that the teacher himself or herself needs to read. And you ought to have both kinds of experiences, and your students should have both kinds of experiences. That is, the student should be exposed to a broad experience of reading. As he reads, he should read a wide variety. Avoid the rut like a plague. Do not allow yourself or your students to get into a rut of reading only one kind of thing, thinking about only one kind of thing. So read something of everything. But this first part, read everything of something. Every student, every teacher should also have the experience of being very interested, passionately interested in some specific area, whether it's family history, whether it's tractors, whether it's recipes, whether it's Greek cuisine. Doesn't really matter so much what it is, but you ought to have the experience of recognizing the depth. If we do not have that experience, why, we don't realize how deep knowledge can go and how deep experience can be in these various areas. So in the reading, in the writing, in the classroom experience, make sure that you have both the survey, the breadth, and also at some point in the year, some depth. Another quote, "What blockheads are those wise persons who think it necessary that a child should comprehend everything it reads?" Southey, I think he's the person who wrote The Three Bears. I'm not positive on that. But the thought here is, avoid like the plague again, the idea that everything that's read must be analyzed. The analytical mind is a part of our Western heritage to take things apart. And so if you're really that extreme and someone gives you a toy, the first thing that has to happen is that toy must be taken apart. And today's world with our plastic toys, if they're taken apart, they do not go back together again and they cannot be used. And so the analytical mind is a curse in some respects. If you're going to have your friends over and have a good time, you don't sit down and analyze every time you meet. Now, what made this a good evening? And what are we doing right now? And why did you ask that question? And what might the next question be? And what are the ingredients of this delicious dessert that you served me? There's a time when to analyze something is almost profane. You experience it. You live it. You enjoy it. It becomes a part of you. And you go on. And I think one of the best ways to kill appreciation for stories and poetry, with young children especially, is to analyze them, to take them apart. So, this is not a class in literature, so we will not, but don't feel burdened to take everything apart and see the parts. Here's one for the teachers especially and for everyone. Resolve to edge in a little reading every day, if it is but a single sentence. Yes, if you don't have time to read, that means that you place more value on other things. If you really are pressed, at least pick up a book of quotes. And if you don't get anything more done in a day than your personal devotions, read a quotation at random. All objects lose by too familiar a view. All objects lose by too familiar a view. Now read one sentence and think about that a little bit. You look too closely at anything and it loses. Is that true? What's it true of? You can do them at random. You can pursue subjects. The public is wiser than the wisest critic. Well, decide whether that's true, whether you agree with it. Read a little bit every day if it's only one sentence. Reading furnishes the mind only with the materials of knowledge. It is thinking that makes what we read ours. I know the experience. All right, the students have read the lesson. And they have filled out the worksheets. They have gotten the answers correct. We have checked the answers, and now I suppose we go to the next lesson. What else is there to say, to do? We have read the lesson and filled in the worksheets. Well, So far as we apprehend and see the connection of ideas, so far it's ours. Without that, it's so much loose matter floating in our brain. It's only after you have read the material and answered some questions on it, only after you have actually laid the cards on the table, after you put the food on the plate, only then are you ready to start talking about it, writing about it, thinking about it. So yes, there is that content. And it is foolish to try to discuss something if we don't have data, material experiences to discuss. But on the other hand, it's also not very beneficial to simply accumulate without then doing something with it. And that's what we will be talking about in our rating here. A couple more quotes. It's not what people eat, but what they digest that makes them strong. And so we're thinking here of taking in and processing, thinking, wrestling with, making it part of you. The food in your mouth is really not yours. It's only in your mouth. It might as well be in your hand, as far as that goes. And food in the stomach is still not yours. It must actually be digested, and so we must work with what we have. And last, we have the quote, the classic quote by Bacon, that reading makes a full man. So when we read, and in fact, if we read too much, we can get full. And conference, referring to conversation, talking, discussion, chit-chat, conference makes a ready man. That is, we become ready with our answers as we discuss with one another, as we talk and ask questions. But when you ask to write something, oh, what a burden. Makes an exact man. You mean I'm going to have to put that in writing? Well, to take what we read and to talk about it, and then to think about it enough that we write something, it is a task, and that's what we want to look at. I have some handouts here. Maybe I could have some volunteers pass them out. If two of you want to come up and give half of them to somebody else. I suggest that writing serves a variety of purposes, and that's the perspective here. Writing actually helps you to perceive. So on the house level that Steve was talking about, where we have the facts and we have the taking in the facts, writing can help to perceive. The problem is that when we hear something, when we look at something, when we read something, sometimes we haven't really read it, we haven't really taken it in the first place until we're asked to do something perhaps as definite as writing something about it. What do you see? What do you see? What have you heard? And if you're asked to write down in a word or a sentence what you heard, well, that's actually part of perception. And so writing can serve that purpose. Writing can also serve the purpose, and this is a major emphasis here on this on these sessions, of helping us to think or to process. And then writing also helps us with the output. Although this is not a session on creative writing, that's a different subject. I do want to mention, though, before I launch into the handout here, that there are several books that will really help you on this area. One that we did use in a creative writing class this summer has a rather fascinating title. It's entitled, If You're Trying to Teach Kids How to Write, You've Got to Have This Book. That's the title of the book. And there are some of these for sale in the bookstore down at COR, which is out the hall. You'll find that one of these days. The one page, spread of pages that makes this book worth it, the one I've used the most often, is the one that gives the over 200 alternatives to write a story. As teachers, we want our children to write. We say, well, not write a story. Well, there are over 200 alternatives here to writing a story. What else is there to write besides a story? Well, you can write newscasts, you can write quips, quizzes, you can write signs, sequels, sentences, travel posters, telegrams, epithets, predictions, and so on. And then another section in this book, in fact, deals with the subject I'm talking about here, and that is writing across the curriculum, plus many ideas for creative writing per se. Creative writing, by the way, is not something in school for just a separate class. It's something that happens in every class. Another book that's rather new in the market on teaching writing covers teaching writing as a skill and creative writing. It also deals with the writing process, tips and teaching suggestions, and it also has ideas in the back for stimulating writing and also some ideas for teaching writing across the curriculum. Those are some books available on the subject. I'd like us to think of looking at your handout. Why do we have children write? Let's look at the whys, first of all. Well, we have them write to think. In order to foster them, or to require them to consider, to organize, to evaluate, to judge, and to use, somehow we take this that we've heard, that we've taken in, and somehow we have to do something with it. Do something with it. When we're writing, we are active. The mind is active. And so I listed some words there, and I will not explain all of them, but as you write, remember, if you have a student write, you might have them write something as little as one word. What word comes to your mind when you think of the Civil War? Write down one word on your paper right now, everybody. All right, you could do that. And so it can be as little as one word. A bit like when you ask a question, you throw the question out and you expect one person to answer, and the other person's minds often go into neutral, especially if they know that you're going to call on that one person. If you ask everybody to write the one word down or write the answer down, why, then everybody needs to do it. And you might take time for everybody to read the answer. You might only have one person read the answer. But here are some things they can explain, describe, and when I say engage, I mean writing engages them with a subject. You can't write about something without somehow wrestling with it. And it stimulates. Sometimes you only understand something as you write in the subject. You experience. The third column there across, you converge, that is, you narrow in, you focus in on something, and you specify, you come in. Sometimes writing is designed to cause you to focus on something and look at the details. What details do you see, or what details can you list? Lists are easy things to have them write. Sometimes you want them to specify, and then the opposite is to connote the poem, the story, what things go along with this. Sometimes you want them to develop the big picture, to generalize. These are some things that we're trying to accomplish as we have them write. We want them to explore their own ideas, explore their own feelings about something. Explore their abilities. Try something you haven't tried before. Try writing in five words. Try writing a haiku. Try writing something, an ability. Also to explore their memories. And then also to sense. So these are some purposes. Why have the children write in the context of the classroom? Basically, it can be used as a tool for any class. How do we do it? Well, some suggestions. Together on the board, send a scribe to the board. Have students give sentences, have students give ideas, or have everybody go to the board. Have them write in small groups and then share their results. Have them write on the wall, probably on the... you can put a big poster on the wall, a big butcher paper, use a bulletin board. Put it on the wall. I tried to stimulate your imagination here a bit, the blacktop, have them record, which is a form of writing. and with and without pressure. That's significant. There are times that students often wonder, is this going to be graded? Well, sometimes it is, sometimes not. Sometimes you can suggest that they write something and read it tomorrow. I like to give alternative assignments. And sometimes you can have a standing offer that anytime I give us an assignment in history, anytime you want to, if you want to devise your own writing exercise instead, you're welcome to do that. Show up tomorrow. Instead of doing this worksheet, show up with a poem or a song or a story or something that uses the same material. And sometimes there'll be a student who will take you up on it. And of course, in that case, why it has to have required some energy that would have been somewhat equivalent to what would have been involved in the assignment. But sometimes some options. Students do need to be assigned to write, or they won't, but there are other times that if the pressure is off and it's either not graded or sometimes the amount of time puts pressure on, the lack of an assigned time takes some pressure off. When do you write? Well, you can do it any time. Writing is something to think in terms of having students write in any class, whether that's on index cards, whether it's just in the margin of their, maybe they have a notebook and they're taking notes and you might want them to write a word or a phrase or sentence. They might just scribble it on a piece of scratch paper or in their notes and you call for responses from that. That kind of writing would be instead of just a verbal answer. So, in any class, at home, while they're listening, before an experience, whether it's before a field trip, before watching a film, before having a speaker come in and visit, before a devotional, before a reading that you read to them, and then after. And you might get some guidelines for that, and they can compare the before and after, impressions before, impressions after, what I thought of before, what I think of after. In different moods, when students are excited, interested in something, when they're not interested in something, when they're stimulated, when they're bored, all times. And then where, anywhere. The place where you actually physically go to write does affect the writing. So whether it's in the classroom, whether you assign it as a something specifically to be done at home. I want you to write this at home. Whatever. I list some other ones there. There's just simply stimulating ideas. It does make a difference. Those other ones might apply more to creative writing exercises as opposed to writing activities to do during a class. And then how do you go about grading or evaluating writing? What do you do about that? Well, don't feel bound to evaluate or to assign a grade to collect or even read everything that your students write. You don't evaluate or grade every answer a student gives in class. Every time a student raises his hand and gives an answer, you don't say, okay, that's a B plus. And the next one answers, that's a C. You won't get much answers from them. And so the same thing, they ought to be writing that much that you wouldn't even consider reading everything they write. They won't even read aloud to everyone everything they write because there are opportunities to write, whether they're short pieces or whatever, they don't necessarily read them all. But those then that you can also collect some things and read them, and some things can simply be okay, satisfactory. You get credit for having done the assignment, or you don't. And then you can have that's either a credit or non-credit. And then you can also devise a very simple point, one for outstanding, two for okay, whatever. Or you can somehow fit it into your grading system. But when you do assign a grade to something a student has written, they need to know what they're being evaluated on. And there are times that you might collect something that you actually expect have been written, and then revised, and then edited, and proofread for everything, and you might actually grade it across the board for everything, spelling, punctuation, the whole works. They ought to know that that's going to happen. But many times, you grade for whatever their goal was. The student needs to know, what are you really looking for in this particular assignment? Am I supposed to try something that I never tried before? I've never written, I just can't do rhyme. But we're supposed to try to do rhyme. Well, that's the thing we're looking at then. But if you say, you're also going to have the rhythm right, and you're going to have some good personification in there, some alliteration, well, we'll go to pieces. So isolate, this is true with any lesson, isolate that which you want to focus on and grade on that. You can also grade various types of things. You can grade the draft, that is the rough copy, and say, I'm looking here for the free flow of ideas. I want you to brainstorm. I want you to try this, and that's what I'm looking for. And you can grade both final copies. You can also grade only the presentation or effort. And there are other things you could add to the list. And last but not least, with publishing, what about the things that students write? What should we do with what they write? It does make a difference if this is going to somehow be published. That is, if it's going to go further than just to the teacher's desk and back to myself. It does, there's value in some type of sharing with a larger group. It makes it more worthwhile, more real. It also puts more interest into the work. And so you can publish some things, whether you hang them on the wall, have them read aloud to each other in pairs or to the whole class if there's time, have them take it home and read it to the parents, call somebody up on the telephone and read it to Great Aunt Susie over the phone. She will be delighted. And exchange writings between schools, between classes, within the same school, between individuals. Booklets that are put together. And you can, might even send something off, you can, whatever. There are some various ways of publishing. Well, these are some reasons to write, how to go about it, publishing. Now, you ought to have in your toolbox some basic tools. When you assign an assignment, when you assign something to a class, typically we have this question of how are we going to get them to engage their minds with the material, as we heard in the last session. So whether it's a science lesson they're going to read for the next day, whether it's history or even math, our question, how are we going to have the student really engage himself with the material? And one of the things that typically we can assign the material in the book, and that's often fine, but suppose we want to have the student do some writing, either in class or as an assignment. And by the way, much of the writing should be done in class. If it's always just assigned as something to do outside of class or at home, why, there's something missed. Some students do very well with that, but there ought to be some experience of actually in class in the next 5 minutes. We're all ready. Now, I called what I would consider to be the dozen bread and butter forms of writing. These are ones that you ought to, I did not hand this out to you, so you can copy them down. They'll be worth more to you if you copy them. And you don't have to copy the same 12 that I picked. I mean, you might not include them all. But one of them is the story, and it can be rather short, but you can, whether you're reading history or geography, science, you can think in terms of how could I use writing story as an instructional tool, whether the story is five sentences, whether it's just an outline for a story, or whether it actually is a story. But story, writing stories, and they can be very short. They don't need to be long, writing stories. Another one is a character sketch. We are people. Life is involved with working and living and around people. Subjects can become rather dry and conceptual. but people are people. And think of the living, breathing people that are referred to in your history books, in your geography books, in your science books, in art, in stories, in literature. Think of the people. And the character sketch, having the person introduce us, write a character sketch of Andrew Jackson, if in history. Write it so that if he walked into the room, we would know. If we had, were in a police lineup of 10 people, we could pick out him. Or if you were allowed to ask him a question, you would know who it was. Now, you can't write a character sketch of somebody referred to in a history book without knowing something about the person. And you're going to have to think about the person. What kind of a man would have removed the Indians to the west, cleared things out for the white men? What kind of a man was that? And you have to ask yourself questions. So, how do you think he, do you think he ever sang a song? Do you think he ever, what kind of house did he live in? Did he get up early in the morning? You have to, getting people to think about people as people, the character sketch. Now here's the compare, contrast. And this you can start, by the way, in first grade or kindergarten. A very important ability, which we think of as a thinking tool, but writing, the simple little list. What are fine, you can start out, you can introduce this, doing it on the chalkboard, send the scribe to the chalkboard. What are three ways in which these are alike, three ways in which they are different? Whether you're studying a fish, how is a fish like a bumblebee, how is it different? Or whether it's two time periods in history, whether it's two parts of the world, two climates, whether it's two schools, two people, to whatever. Compare and contrast. Notice, this is, you haven't understood something. And often you understand something better by, you can often understand two things, learn two things at the same time easier than you can learn one alone, because with the contrast and the comparison, it helps you to do that. And whether it's a list, or then with older children, encourage them, require them to develop this into a paragraph form of writing where the one paragraph compares things and the other contrasts it. Because it does require you then to develop your sentences. Conversation. This is a writing form, not a speaking form. Conversation. Write a conversation in which Abraham Lincoln meets George Washington. Well, that requires a little imaginative thinking. You say, wait a minute, they weren't concurrent. No, they weren't. They didn't live at the same time. But write the conversation anyway. Write a conversation in which two people in history, two mathematicians, two scientists, two story characters. To write the conversation or dialogue, you have to be able to imagine, feel as that person felt. And then we're going to read that. And you can do it very short. Write a brief conversation between two people we're studying here. Take 5 minutes to do that. When we're finished, why? You read the conversation. Read them. Defining. Defining. This is an important tool. In fact, someone has suggested that in most of our content subjects anyway, and conceptual subjects, if you can define the terms, you probably know half the material right there. And terms and vocabulary, defining what's meant by sacrilege, what is meant by manifest destiny, what's meant by lymph. What is lymph? Defining term, writing them. And especially if you can define them in your own words. And then, of course, thinking ahead to speaking, can you give the definition orally? If you can stand up and define something, you have it. If you can't, no, you don't have it. Person says, well, I know what it means, I know what time is, but I can't tell you what it is. Well, then you don't really know what time is. Well, we could talk about that in a while. We could write about that, but we won't. But, yes, defining. Next one, description. Description. There's what the man with the fish did. Describe. Whatever, an event, an experience, something out of your experience. Describe. And a Along with describe, you might put /explain, describe or explain, how to explain how to do this or describe how this happens. Describe. Sometimes in these little descriptive activities, you might limit them to one sentence only. And describe in one sentence, something from the lesson. A journal. Journal. Now, this is a whole subject in itself, whether this is a student keeping his or her own journal about things they've learned, but what I'm really thinking of here is, for example, writing a journal entry for some person that you're studying, in which he reports what he did. Write what you suppose is a journal entry for one of the army officers leading or removing the Cherokees to the west. One of these officers who was involved in removing the Cherokees kept a journal. I want you to write his evening entry for one of these. And it requires you to think personally, to put some feel, to put the personal element there. Write a journal entry for Galileo the evening after he was told to recant his idea that the earth revolves around the sun. Journal entry of anyone, any subject. A letter. This would be similar to the journal, but similar to the conversation, but a letter in which someone writes to something. Or write a letter to someone. Write a letter to someone. I want you to write a letter to General Sherman. You read that he made this famous march to the sea, leaving devastation behind him after you learned the details. I want you to write a letter to him. Just tell him whatever you have to tell him. Don't tell them what they're supposed to tell him. Any historical character, any Bible character, write a letter to Haman. He's going to receive it just before the banquet. Write a letter to him. What would you tell him? Write a letter to. And lists. Lists can be quite a bit of fun. What do we know about this subject, especially maybe before you're starting a new subject? Send them to the board. Right, everything you know, I referred to the digestive system earlier. You're starting to study a body system. Go up to the board. When I say go, single words only, write any word that you know has something significant to do with the digestive system. 5 minutes. Why, after 30 seconds, why the chalk tapping stops. And they stand there, and the list isn't very long. But that's what they know. They do know something. And you try that some other time, and you hope that the list is longer. Think lists. How can we make a list? Things we know, things we don't know, things we like to know. What happened here? Poems. I show a bit of a bias there, perhaps, but having students try a poem about a subject, celebrating something, after having read something at the end of a unit, you have essay questions. You might also give the option of writing a poem dealing with it. Poetry allows you to deal with subjects that you cannot comprehend. The problem with the denotative kind of writing, the specific writing, is that you have to have control of this thing in order to describe it. Well, what about something you can't describe? Suppose it's bigger than you are. Well, what do you do? Well, you have to resort to figurative language, and that calls for poetry. And then the last two, reporting. Yes, report. Find out about something. Whether that means talking to a parent, reading an encyclopedia, simply reading what was in your text, and suppose you know that tomorrow when you come to class, at the beginning of the period, you will have a blank piece of paper in front of you and you'll be asked to write two sentences reporting what you've learned in the assignment, and you'll be graded on those two sentences. Well, you have to know, first of all, something that you've learned and be prepared to write it down. Now, you can prepare them all ahead and memorize it and write them down. Fine. That means you really put some effort into it, but reporting. And then question and answer. And I'm referring here to writing, not to dialogue here, but writing questions and writing answers. So you can imagine what the question and answer might have been between two people. Ask Abe Lincoln a question. Then what would you think his answer would be? You can't do that without knowing something about him or his background. Or have one person that you've read about ask another person a question and write what you think his answer would be. Question and answer. Writing questions and answers, imaginatively. Those are 12 bread and butter tools you can use, and as you approach a lesson, you can ask yourself, how can I use one of those writing activities in the class? Now, I'll take the remaining time here to... I'm going to give you one handout, right? I have another handout that deals with the history and geography writing activities. So we will look at some activities here, and tomorrow we'll spend a bit more time actually trying some activities because I'll have this introductory material behind us. Teaching history and geography. There are basically two parts of history, I suggest. One is people and one is their deeds. People and their deeds. And as you approach history, think in terms of people living and acting and interacting, agreeing, fighting, building, cooperating, killing, warring, whatever. People are out there, active, and deeds. They are doing things. Now, we can tend to approach history, and one of our problems is in teaching history and geography is that we have these conclusions, these generalizations, and we often teach these conclusions and generalizations and big ideas as things for the children to learn and to memorize, and they need to learn some of those. But we give the top up here, and there's not a foundation for it to stand on. And if I told you that as a result of a long period of trouble, the Smithers family eventually moved out of the village of Tagaloo and left the Hammers family own the place. Now, I want you to remember that for the test. Tell me how you feel. Somebody, tell me how you feel. Shall I repeat it? The Smithers family, after a long period of struggle with the Hammers family, moved out of the village of Tagaloo and left the Hammers to have the community kind of to themselves. That's on tomorrow's test. Eugene, how do you feel? It's boring because it's irrelevant, you said. It has nothing to do with your life or anything that you care about. Right? Now, somehow, one of the things we need to do is have our students care. Do you care? Do you care about the classes you're going to have this year or what you're going to teach? If you don't, don't expect them to. Do you care? And do they care? Do they care? The question is not whether they can use it. The question is whether they care. Well, looking at the list here, think of people. People. And so, and this is not a broad-based look at how to teach history, but writing activities. Writing activities. Lists. Lists of facts about a historical figure. Whether it's facts about the person's background, the work the person has accomplished, the person's ideals, the person's accomplishments. What are some things, for example, as an assignment, you're going to read about one major character, maybe, a person, maybe a president, maybe a general, maybe an inventor. And I want you tomorrow to have a list, or maybe at the end of this period, list. And character qualities. Try to think about the character qualities of that person. You know, people, there are colorful people in history. Maybe encourage them to either find out or to even make up the rest of the story. I'm referring there, I have in quotes, because Paul Harvey has two books out, I believe, called The Rest of the Story. And this, we learned that King Henry VIII divorced a wife or two or three, had some executed, and he wanted a wife who would give him a son. And also he, in order to do that, he had to break off the Catholic Church and became head of the Church of England. And that's a little bit intriguing, but it's kind of far away in both time and place. It is one of the things that we're expected to remember in world history. Well, Paul Harvey here tells a story called The Upper Hand. King Henry VIII and Queen Catherine and Anne Boleyn, a noted triangle in the romantic geometry of 16th century England. Anne began as an attendant to Queen Catherine, but quickly the two became rivals. Eventually, Anne won. She succeeded Catherine as Henry's queen. But during that bitter, lopsided rivalry, the aging Queen Catherine just once got the upper hand. Anne was only 12 years old when her father, Sir Thomas Boleyn, took her to France. There, she entered the royal service, remained for 3 years. Even then, her appearance was impressive, though not particularly dazzling. She had large eyes, raven black hair, a soft dark complexion, and she wore gloves. She wore gloves. At 15, Anne returned to England. Her grandfather was one of King Henry's leading ministers, her father's prestige was ascending, and her elder sister was an attendant in the royal court. Quite naturally, Anne Boleyn herself became known and accepted in the court. Soon she joined the Queen's own entourage. The poet Sir Thomas Wyatt was among her admirers at the time. Whispers said that something was related to her gloves. Gradually, throughout Henry's increasing displeasure with Queen Catherine, the younger Anne became his favorite. Then the rivalry began. In the midst of the competition with her youthful rival, the Queen desperately mobilized her meager wit, her remaining authority, her sharp tongue. These turned Henry more off than on. Also, Catherine had not given him a son. And as Henry's antipathy for the Queen intensified, so did his desire for an heir to the throne, and so did his love for the lovelier Anne Boleyn. The Queen did not give up. At times, when the three were together, the Queen would play her ace. Why, she would ask, would Anne not remove her gloves? And Anne, conspicuously hurt, would sit silent. Catherine escalated her caustic taunt to open scorn. To the Queen, Anne epitomized her own waning youth. Her bitterness festered. She became increasingly petulant. Why would Anne not remove her gloves, the Queen demanded. And Anne would only respond with silence. Eventually, her patience was rewarded with a crown. That Henry eventually turned against his younger bride with such vehemence that his anger cost her her life may or may not have had anything to do with those gloves, with imagined sorcery, with what court tattlers called the sign of a witch. But history does record that one desperate day, the older queen's taunt became an order. And that day, Catherine sought and got the upper hand, if only for a little while. For on that day, by royal command, Anne Boleyn removed her gloves, revealed for all and for the king to see the ugliness of a deformed left hand, the hand that had six fingers. And now you know the rest of the story. Now, I simply read that one to point out that everybody we read about in science, history, math, was or is a person. And somehow you can't begin to find out that personal information about everybody you read. The point isn't to learn personal information about everybody you read, but to be aware that there is personal information and to be introduced to that occasionally. And so you can have students do a bit of digging occasionally, try to find out something about a person, whether it's using an encyclopedia, whether it's finding a book, or Book of Presidential Facts, find out something human about the person. And then writing back to your paper lists what makes a good, whatever, you fill in the blank. List 10 qualities that you think make a good inventor or a good president. And then, did this person have them? Writing a mini biography, journal entries of historical character, supposed journal entries, introduce us to a typical person of the Middle Ages. A peasant of the Middle Ages, introduce us to him by letting us know what a typical day was like, how he lived, what he ate, what he worshipped, how he worshipped, what he wore. See, we learned that in the Middle Ages there were peasants, but do we really feel that human dimension? They actually lived. They didn't go to Walmart, but where did they go to get their supplies? How were they? There's another good comparison-contrast idea. And then an advice column. What would this historical person say to this question? What do you suppose, knowing what you do about this person, what would he say if you ask him this question? What would be his counsel, his advice? What would George Washington say to having political parties? And then deeds. We usually call them events. We talk about great historical events, or great historical deeds, and that betrays a bit of a bias of these things happened. Nothing just happens. Everything has someone behind it. So I challenge you to have current deeds talks in your school, not current events. People are doing things. And if it looks like it just happened, well, God was behind it. Anyway, list the details. List the details. Explore the backgrounds. Write this up in a news article with an inverted pyramid format. That is with the least important details at the end. Write a story. Here's one I didn't add to your list. But write a story related to a period that you are studying in history. There used to be a series of books called We Were There. We Were There, and there were about 20 or 30 of them. We were there at Pearl Harbor. We were there in the Oregon Trail. We were there at the Boston Tea Party. That kind of writing. And then again, the last comment, current deeds, that is current events. After having looked at a photograph or read an article from today's paper, then have the students respond in writing by something like having that person speak. Say what I think. These are some of my impressions. Or require them, after having had the article read to them, say, now, I want you to write what a pro-lifer, how a pro-lifer would respond to this, how a pro-choice person would respond to this. How would a new immigrant from Spain, what do you suppose a Mexican immigrant, well, how would he respond to this? Write your response. Write your response. All right, we will stop here, and tomorrow we will pick up more on the writing activities for history and launch into the other subjects also. I'd like to first remind you on the one sheet we looked at yesterday what we are trying to do when we think of writing across the curriculum. And by the way, do not get the impression that I'm suggesting that every single class period ought to have some writing in it. There are many strategies to use in teaching, and the worst method is the one you use all the time. So if the students would get the idea that in every class we're going to have to pick up the pencil and write something, they would wonder, couldn't we have at least one class where we could relax and just talk or do something? So don't get the impression that I'm saying every class should involve writing. But that's my subject here, and since writing is one of the perhaps more difficult things to come up with to have students do, we're focusing on that. But the four things I want you to remind yourself again on the sheet I passed out yesterday, four basic purposes that writing can serve is to call children to consider the subject that is before us, whether it's the study of Venus, whether it's the study of how birds fly, how flies can walk across the ceiling, or the study of of the feudalism in the Middle Ages, consider, think about, play with, toy with, handle over, look at it from various perspectives. And then the second one is, a second purpose with writing is to somehow take this material that we have now perceived, that we've considered, and somehow organize. And these are not necessarily following logical sequence. These are simply four different kinds of activities, and you don't need to use them all four each time. Organize somehow this material, or as my one younger nephew said years ago when his father explained something to him, he asked, how can I hang that onto something? And he worded very well what we are desperate for when we learn something new. How does that have anything to do with anything that I knew before? If it doesn't have somehow fit in, it's just a loose piece of information that will float off somehow. And then a third purpose is to evaluate somehow, to take what we have read, heard, whether it's a story, whether it's a lottery, or whether it's a current event, a current deed in the world, and to somehow be able to lay that alongside a standard and say, this is good, or these qualities, these aspects are good. And by the way, there's so much good in the worst of us and so much bad in the best of us that I forget the rest of the saying, but we want to avoid our students just categorically reading something and saying, that is no good and this is good, whether it's a deed that some historical person did. There are things to analyze, to understand about them. So to evaluate, and then last of all, another purpose is to somehow use. I'd like to suggest another significant word to keep in mind, especially in our culture, is the word care. Care. Someone asked someone once if he knows the two major problems in America. And he said, I don't know and I don't care. And he said, you're right. And if we don't care, we're not going to want to know. And so do you care about that next lesson that your students are reading? If you don't care about it, why should they? Maybe you oughtn't to study it. Just because it's in the book doesn't mean that it needs to be read or at least have as much attention as some other things. Another purpose of writing is some of these basic question words. The what. If we don't know what, we can't begin to discuss, we can't test, we can't do anything. We have to first know what. And that involves getting the information, getting the facts, actually seeing what's there. And you can follow that up with, then what? Then what? We have to first lay the facts on the table. And this writing can serve this purpose. That is, you can read something or you can hear something read, but actually writing down what? What are the facts here? What are the important things? What happened? Helps you to organize those butterflies flying around in your mind. And under the then what, we have the other basic questions too. How, when, where, why? These are some things, questions that we live with as we study. When did it happen? What happened? Where? Why? How does this thing work? All these are some basic underpinnings that direct our writing. And then here is one. So what? That's a typical question in our culture. So what? Now, I'll refrain from talking about usefulness too much, but the so what, one of the bad questions that's asked in our culture is, what good will this ever do me? How can I ever use this? That's the wrong question to ask about many things. And I don't have time to talk about that more now. But the so what, nevertheless, that gets here to the so what. So what? So what if he did do it in history? So what? Why would I read it? Well, you have to know why in your own heart. You have to know why. So what? If you don't know why, so what? We study that butterflies fly or metamorphosis occurs. How are your students going to know? So what? Answer that for yourself. And if there is a so what, therefore, we think this, do that, understand this, or since this is significant or important, we will write this, we will remember this. And in conclusion, now what? So that we've learned something, now what? Is this going to have anything to do with my life? Well, there are a couple major ways. The one is, yes, now I can understand something that I before did not understand. And by the way, understanding is one of the strongest motivators. That's why children go through that why stage. Why? Enough to drive you to your frustration when they're young. But somehow we are very good at extinguishing that in children. We're very good at extinguishing that behavior. Why? Well, understanding. We're desperate for understanding. And that's one of the major reasons of the so what and the now what. So we can understand it. And it gives us insight. It gives us insight, which leads to appreciation. And I submit that this is one of the major reasons that we study the things we do in school. To appreciate. We are appreciating the world in which we live. Valuing it. It's God's world. And we learn about Him through the things we study. And sometimes also we can do or use. That is a value of some of the things that we learn in school. But it's not probably the main one. Probably not the main one. Well, these are some underpinnings. I had this list up yesterday and went over it. And I gave you a handout today to help you a bit on applying these as writing tools, writing forms, and these are intended not, this particular list is geared to using the tool across the curriculum. And so, for example, description or explanation, this is actually should be probably two separate ones, or explanation of some circumstances or a process. A good example of a writing tool in any kind of a science class or math class that involves some process, understanding one. And so you can keep that list handy. You'll find it useful here shortly. I want to call your attention then to the sheet we finished with yesterday on history and geography writing activities. And we finished yesterday pointing out that history involves two major things. People, living, breathing, warm-blooded people who were once young as you are and lived this life like you did. And secondly, deeds, things that they did, and it involves motives and so on. Now, a few specific ideas. Some of these are more significant activities that you wouldn't be your daily bread and butter type of activities to do in class. But if you try it sometime, if you have your students try writing a contract or writing a law, they can soon find out how difficult it is to think of all the problems, all the eventualities, all the loopholes. And they can see for themselves how frustrating it is, especially if you try to write a law that has something to do with behavior at school, and see how complicated this would get in writing out directions for how we shall line up and what happens, what's the penalty if a person doesn't line up properly, what will the penalty be the first time, second time, third time. They can soon get an idea how you could develop a book and how difficult it is to write laws and get some understanding on how, in the whole political process, it's an endless, endless task. And then on the back side of your paper, number two, other roads that could have been traveled, thinking of Robert Frost's Two Roads Diverge in the Yellow Wood. Suppose, by the way, using the imagination in some writing is very, very absolutely necessary. A person who cannot imagine cannot go beyond the here and the now and the definite and what is here. If you can't imagine anything being any different than what it is, why, you can't really do much. You have to imagine what a clean room would look like in order to really clean one with purpose. And so, a few suggestions there. And reporting. Some of these could be local items. And the one in geography, number five, would be a project.
that. I'm not suggesting you do that every day or with every country, but it's an idea of a kind of thing that could be done. Item number 6, what is happening elsewhere in the world right now? An awareness that we're not alone in this world. There are other people living right now. Wycliffe has a fascinating little book out called In Any Given Day in the Life of the Bible. And a few years back, they coordinated their people they had working all over the world. And on one particular day, they photographed activities happening around the world on that exact same day. And as you page through this book, you are taken to different parts of the world, to Africa, to the East Africa, and you see people living and working in different parts of the world. Now, of course, many of these involve the Wycliffe work. That's fine. That's the purpose of the book. But somehow, we want to have our students be aware that we're not alone in this world, and there are other people who are having days also. And how can you have them write about this? Well, again, some research, some writing, finding some illustrations using National Geographic or whatever. What I'd like to do now for just a couple minutes is item number 7. I have 3 time periods here. I just chose it at random. A time of religious persecution in Europe, thinking of our Anabaptist forebears and others even before that being persecuted for their faith. Frontier days in America or the American Great Depression. Now, what I'd like you to do is think of those time periods and take this list. And you don't have to limit yourself to this list, but I'd like you to make a list in about 2 minutes of some writing assignments. They could be as short as something that could be done in a minute, or they could be an overnight assignment that might take 30 minutes or 45, or they could be a long-term assignment. But some kind of a writing assignment that deals with one or more of these time periods. The times of religious persecution in Europe, frontier days in America, or the American Great Depression. What are some writing assignments you could give your students? Those are some of those obviously take longer than others. That's fine. Some are short activities, some are longer. What I'd like to do next is read to you a selection, and since I don't have copies for you, I'll read this. I'm going to read a short selection about modern China. And we're assuming here that the students are going to read this selection together, probably either before class or in class. And then this time, instead of discussing or going to the board or whatever, you're going to have them write something immediately after it's read. So you listen closely and listen to get the information first before you think of, if you're thinking too much of how you're going to have them write, why then you won't get the information. Modern China. Today, the People's Republic of China is one of the most densely populated nations in the world. Over 1/5 of all the people of the world live in China. The Chinese people are very industrious and have a great sense of family and country pride. They believe that it is very important to be respectful and polite, especially to elderly people. Since the people are hard workers, the country has prospered. However, because of the communist system, very little of the wealth makes it to the individual who works long, hard hours for little pay. Many of China's people live and work in rural areas. When the communists took over China, they took the farms away from individual people and said that the land and the work of the people belonged to the state. However, the communist system of governmental control does not work well for the prosperity of the nation. Chinese officials have more recently seen the problem, and some land has been given back to individuals, but the communists still keep a very tight control. Chinese farming has changed very little from the methods used hundreds of years ago. Water buffalo are still used to pull simple farm machines, and most work is done by hand. Rice, the main crop, is usually eaten at every meal. Since rice must be grown in 2 to 6 inches of water, workers use flooded areas or flood the field purposely. Small ridges or dikes are made to hold back the water. The land is drained just before harvest time. Now, as many history books are, this is loaded with information. It's concentrated. It's almost like reading from a dictionary. So my question is now, assume that we read this, and this time, today, you're going to have your students take a piece of paper and pencil, and they're going to write for about, let's choose this time, something that wouldn't take more than 10 minutes, something that could be done in 5 to 10 minutes. And by the way, it wouldn't have to be finished, but well underway, but then they might just throw it away. It's a learning exercise. All right, go. Let's have some lists of what you would have them do with pencil and paper after having read that lesson. All right. And as your children get older in the upper grades, also sometimes have them point out the author's bias. The author's bias came through here a couple times. Did you hear it? Some assumptions. Statements such as, since the people are hard workers, the country has prospered. Cause and effect. You may or may not agree, but that is an author's bias coming through. The author is stating that. And however, because of the communist system, very little of the wealth makes it to the individual who works long, hard hours for little pay. The assumption being if they had a capitalist system, the wealth would make its way to the person who works long, hard hours for little pay. All right. With older students, sometimes you want to call them to recognize author's assumptions. You may agree with the assumptions, you may not, but you ought to recognize that. All right. Let's look at another handout that came this morning on science health writing activities. So you're teaching a science or health class. What are some kinds of writing activities? Well, thinking of a day in the life of, some of you may be old enough to remember the Joe articles in the Reader's Digest. In fact, I think we can still buy them as reprints. I think they ran back in the 70s. I am Joe's stomach. I am Joe's liver. I am Joe's pancreas. And you can still buy those reprints. But that type of writing in which you, as you study something or after you've studied something, you write, whether it's an animal, a bird, or a body organ, I am Joe's heart. And Joe's heart speaks and tells you about the typical day and about his life. A drop of water in the water cycle, going completely through the water cycle. Biography of a tree. In fact, there are a couple good books on that subject. There's a good book called Wild Animals I Have Known by Ernest Thompson Seton. I'm not sure if it's still in print. You can probably find copies in the library in which this writer actually wrote about the life of animals he knew personally in his community. And that would be a challenge, in fact, to have your students learn to know a wild animal. Did you ever know personally, individually, a wild animal, a rabbit, a bird, and know which bird it was, which rabbit it was that always came by your garden, and know about a day in his life? And a directory of something, a directory, your own directory, perhaps of diseases or ailments as you study these in health. So what are the causes? What are the symptoms? What are the speculations surrounding it, myths about causes, treatments, and alternative treatments? And then any directions, how to write a how-to. And this applies to many, many areas of science or health. How to keep good hygiene, tooth hygiene in your mouth. What are the 10 important steps for having good hygiene, personal hygiene, or how to brush your teeth? Identify a tree. How to wire a switch, balance the menu, whatever. Being able to precisely explain how to do something or how something works. Some of you might be familiar with David Macaulay's book, On the Way Things Work. I think this probably appeals to fellows more than girls, it seems, and oftentimes it's the parents that will visit the bookstore and they'll pick this up for the children. Really young children aren't fascinated by these often as much as older people. Nevertheless, the whole idea of choosing anything, whether it's the wing of an airplane, how it works, this can involve both sketching and writing, and a refrigerator, or the cooling system on an automobile, how it works, how an air conditioner works. Fascinating study for today. Or how it doesn't work. Hydraulic machines, the jump jet, or a submersible, submarine. And so, simply have students explain in writing and maybe include some sketches on how this thing works. In fact, instead of approaching it in your typical approach of reading a chapter or unit, if it's on a subject like that, you could give the assignment first and say, here's your goal, here's the poster, and you're going to design one in which you have some sketches and cover it with explanations of how it works. Science fiction, thinking ahead, and then also trying to back up and imagine that you're a person 100 years ago writing about life in 2000 or 2010, and how might a person like that have speculated what things would be like now, and what would he have not been able to imagine that we have today? And then, of course, the whole area of the scientific approach, the scientific method, carefully designing an experiment, or replicating famous experiments, which falls faster, the heavy thing or the light thing, hypothesizing about that, writing out some ideas, then doing it and recording the results. And number 9, summarizing at the end of a chapter or a unit, whether that can be done together, can be done in groups, get together, see how long a list you can come up with of things we've learned in this chapter. Write it down. What I'd like to do is read to you a selection I chose more or less at random from a science book I picked off the shelf here. And then I'd like you to do what we just did. And by the way, in the science, remember to choose something that fits. If you're not the imaginative type, story writer, poetry type person, why, just because you see them up here, don't think story poem every assignment you have. You can think of your more bread and butter, compare, contrast, list kinds of things. But what would you have students write after this lesson? I'll read a couple paragraphs about the planet Mercury. Mercury, the second smallest planet, is similar to our moon in that it is rocky, barren, and pocked with craters. By the way, this is a dry subject, isn't it? Mercury is very dry. Because Mercury is the closest planet to the sun, it is visible only in the bright twilight glow after sunset or just before sunrise. The planet has numerous mountains on one side, formed by violent shock waves from the impact of a huge asteroid. Traveling at a speed of approximately 30 miles per second, Mercury is the speediest planet. It has the shortest year of any planet, orbiting the Sun in only 88 Earth days. During its orbit of the Sun, Mercury slowly rotates on its axis, completing one rotation every 59 Earth days. Thus, a, quote, day on Mercury is quite long, taking up two-thirds of the planet's short year. Because of Mercury's slow rotation and fast orbit, each period of daylight and darkness lasts not one day, as on Earth, but 2 years, 176 Earth days. With hardly a trace of an atmosphere, Mercury receives little protection from the nearby sun's intense radiation and solar wind. The temperatures on Mercury rise and fall to great extremes due to the planet's slow rotation and its inability to produce a greenhouse effect. At high noon, at the hot poles, the temperature can soar to 797 degrees Fahrenheit. On the opposite side of the planet, heat is quickly radiated outward from the surface and lost into space. Nighttime temperatures may drop to nearly 275 degrees below zero Fahrenheit. You read that, your students have read it. Now, how are they going to engage this? Today you decided to have them pull out a pencil and paper and write something. What are you going to have them write? Let's take a couple minutes to come up with some writing ideas as a learning experience. The most fascinating. Or what did you hear here that you didn't know before? What might you remember a year from now? What else? Let's just call out some things. A real challenge would be to, in small groups, suppose you're going to be sent there, 20 people sent there to live in a small colony in Mercury for a year. What are you going to have to provide for yourself? What will be the challenges that you will face? Insurmountable challenges, but that could be fun. You'd have to keep moving yourself around to stay on kind of that edge where the sun line is so you don't freeze or thaw, and you'd have to protect yourself. You have to take food and oxygen and pressure suits and just get them to think of. And then when you discuss them, they could notice what other ones thought of that they didn't. Is it possible? Would it be possible to do that? If so, what would you have to take along? What else? Let me do one other quick one here on the, again, on science. This is on birds. Subsection on the study of birds. And the heading here is rapid digestion. Because the motion of flying requires great quantities of energy, birds eat often. Some very young or very small birds may eat their body weight in food each day. Many birds have a sac in the esophagus called the crop, which stores and moistens food and releases it in a steady stream to the rest of the digestive system. Birds must digest their food rapidly, for the faster they digest it, the sooner they can use the energy and the less digesting food they have to carry. Some fruit-eating birds can, in 30 minutes, completely digest a meal of fruit and excrete the waste products. Since birds have no teeth to chew their food, they have a special organ called a gizzard that grinds food to make it more easily digested in the intestine. Sometimes birds swallow gritty material such as gravel or sand to aid in the grinding process. Unlike other animals, birds do not store much solid or liquid waste within their bodies, for the extra weight would hamper flight. Instead, birds are designed for quick digestion and excretion of waste products. All right? What could you have your students do with pencil and paper in five minutes or so as a little writing exercise to interact with that information? And let's assume they would have access to their books. Go ahead. One I jotted down was, suppose you had to eat your body weight in food each day. Make a list of what would be probably, make up your menu. How many hamburgers, how many bags of chips would it take to make 120 pounds whatever you weigh, in the right proportions? What would you bring to school for lunch? Or how often would you eat? What else? You can just ask one question and have them all write the answer. All write the answer and then call for answers. What else? Okay. Yes. You write a poem describing it and choose the proper fast-moving pace. Compare and contrast bird's digestive system with an animal's. And then design. It's an excellent pace. Excellent place to note the design of the hand of the creator here. Everything about the bird, the breathing system, the air system, designed for efficiency and flight. All right. Let's look in the back side of the sheet that says math rating activities. The outstanding thing about mathematics is that it requires precision, precise thinking. And there is a precise answer and often a precise method. Even though there might be more than one method of getting an answer, there's still a precise step to follow in the method you choose. It involves logic and puzzles, logic problems. And so, oftentimes, a child's problem in math involves not being methodical in the approach. Who's had the experience of having a child come to your desk and ask for help in a math problem, and you ask him, "What is something like this? What's the problem asking, or what have you gotten done so far?" And the child looks at it, and then he says, "Oh," and then he walks back to his desk and finishes answering it without you helping him at all further. Who's ever had that kind of experience? Well, so the problem is to think methodically. First, I must do this. Then I must do this. I must know what the question is. Then I must know what I must use to solve the question. And so sometimes writing clear number directions, if you want a real exercise, have them describe in words how to solve a long division problem and not miss any step. Or make up a game, write rhymes, and so on. Some of these can be more imaginative, like number 5, have some geometric figure introduce his friends and their relationships and how I'm related to the rectangle and how he's different than I am, and so on.
For the most current Faith Builders recordings, visit christianlearning.org. And for more free resources that support teaching and learning, visit thedocforlearning.org.